This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thank you for joining us for the reading of Ira David Wood III's Confessions of an Elf. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and will be available in podcast after the broadcast. We're going to approach this book as though we were perusing it in a bookstore. To begin with, we'll read what's on the back of the book. It's a bit of a blurb about it, followed by a bit of information about the author. Our readings will be in 4 one-hour segments. At the top of the second hour, there will be a 5-minute break, and a second 5-minute break at the end of the second hour. We'll have another break at the top of the fourth hour. Triangle Radio Reading Service extends its thanks to Ira David Wood III for letting us use his book for this broadcast, and also to Robin Bullock for letting us use his music from his CD, Guitar for Christmas. How many naughty littles have you ever really known who actually got switches or lumps of coal on Christmas morning? I don't think anyone honestly believes that this infamous list, supposedly kept by Santa, really amounts to a hill of beans. Naughty or nice, everybody's included in Christmas. Always. That's just the way the boss operates. An elf from the North Pole, on a determined mission, breaks the elfin code of silence in order to bring our 21st century world an update on the true meaning of Christmas and the very real spirit of Santa Claus. His outsider perspective of the world of Biggles offers each person who celebrates Christmas a valuable lesson on the holiday, on their lives, and an inside look on who Santa Claus really is. As he explains it to the author, this isn't as much a book for children as it is a book for the childlike virtues inside all humans, regardless of their age. If the Christmas season is a special time in your life, this book is for you. Ira David Wood III is the founder and executive director of Raleigh, North Carolina's Theater in the Park. David is probably best known and loved for annually portraying the miserly Ebenezer Scrooge in his own musical adaptation of A Christmas Carol, which has been playing in Raleigh since 1974. With 3 international tours to its credit and having played to over 1 million people, the production is now cited as one of the most successful shows in North Carolina theater history. This book consists of an introduction and then 8 sections. Section 1, The World is Full of Elves, is read by Joanna Harris. Section 2, Of Hallow Giving Mass, Heroes and the North Pole, is read by Josh Harris. Section 3, A Dickens of a Day, is read by Pamela Vesper. Section 4, All I Want for Christmas, is read by Blair Jerome. Section 5, The Lost Children, by Joanna Harris. Section 6 is titled Christmas Morning, and that's MOURNING. It's read by Josh Harris. Section 7, The Realness of Santa Claus, is read by Pamela Vesper. And the final section, Section 8, A Lesson from the Lilies, is read by Blair Jerome. I'm Kurt Benrud, and I will be reading the introduction. Mr. Wood dedicates his book to his wife, Ashley. Confessions of an Elf by Ira David Wood III. Introduction. Grasp the subject. The words will follow. Quintus Ennius. Before you read another word in this book, you're going to have to accept four things as fact. 1. My name is Marvin. 2. I'm an elf. 3. I live at the North Pole. 4. I work for Santa Claus. Now, I don't think anyone should have any difficulty with number 1. Except for those of you who labor under the mistaken impression that all of us elves have cute little names like the Seven Dwarfs. Numbers 2 through 4, on the other hand, are definitely going to give a few of you some major trouble. If that's your case, you are what we call a non-believer. If you are a non-believer, there's no reason at all to feel defensive. This book isn't intended to change your mind. It's not my job to make you believe in anything. Either you do or you don't. It's really that simple. So just relax and try to keep up, okay? If you had no problem at all accepting my first four statements, you're what we call a believer. Congratulations. Either way, I'm still going to ask all of you to finish reading this introduction. It's just a matter of establishing some common ground between us. The truth is that most human beings believe in things because they choose to. They choose not to believe in some things for the very same reason. And it doesn't matter whether something they believe in happens to be scientifically provable or not. Human beings simply believe what they want to believe. What's more, they clearly have a habit of accepting information that confirms that belief while tending to reject information that conflicts with it. Proof tends to be what most rational human beings use to defend their choice of beliefs. The trouble is, someone seems to have a little bit of proof to support whatever they choose to believe in. It's been something of a human stalemate for a long time now. The very tough part about all this believing and non-believing business is that it all finally boils down to a question of faith. And I'm not referring to what we at the North Pole called ORC, or obvious religious connotations. In fact, if you don't mind, I'd like to keep the obvious religious connotations as far away from this preliminary discussion as possible. I certainly understand the complication here, because we also happen to be dealing with the subject of Christmas. But that's not what this book is really about. Or at least not what might be considered mainstream ORC. After all, it's going to be enough of a leap for most of you to simply accept the fact that I'm an elf. So let's just say believe what you want to believe and let it go at that for the time being, okay? Thank you. A word of caution now to you believers. This book isn't exactly going to be a romp through the tulips for you either. It's not going to be as easy as simply being asked to clap your hands if you believe in Tinkerbell. You're going to have to commit to a bit more affirmative action where the world's spiritual apathy is concerned. Just wanted to let you know that up front. And please, as long as we're putting it all on the line, let me say that this isn't as much a book for children as it is a book for the childlike virtues inside all humans, regardless of their age. So if the children in your lives are ready for what this book has to say, by all means, share it with them. If not, there's really no need to burden them with all your doubts. They'll be able to read this by the time they need to hear what it has to say. One final word of advice to you believers. The world isn't in the best shape right now. That's one of the main reasons I decided to break the Elfin Code of Silence to write this book. And believers are just as guilty for the condition of the world as non-believers, probably more so. In some situations, that statement happens to be cause for celebration. In other cases, it isn't. I'll be very honest with you. I'm probably going to catch some flack for writing all of this down and getting it into print. But it happens to be my personal opinion that the contemporary world, your world, has really lost touch with Santa Claus. And it just seems to me that we need him more than ever right now. More than that, you need an image of Santa Claus that fits into your present lifestyles. In most cases, everyone still seems to be saddled with the old, cliched images of that right jolly old elf Mr. Clement Moore wrote about in 1822. Well, we are, and we aren't. I mean, do you remember how Santa Claus was dressed in Mr. Moore's poem? All in fur from his head to his foot. Fur, not red felt or even velvet. Well, who are we talking about here? Santa Claus or Daniel Boone? Fur is fur. And fur is a lot of things, but one thing fur isn't is red. Not even fox fur is really red. Not red like the red in Santa's suit, at least not the Santa suit you've come to know over the years. Now don't get me wrong, The Night Before Christmas is a truly wonderful poem, and Santa can be anything you really want him to be. I mean, after all, he was born out of our need for him and for everything he represents to mankind. It was the German-born illustrator Thomas Nast who actually gave the world its visual impression of Santa in his beautiful illustrations for Harper's Weekly, a magazine that was very popular in the 1860s. Believe it or not, the earliest illustration by Nast depicts Santa Claus visiting a Union Civil War camp. It appeared in the January 3, 1863 edition of Harper's Weekly, and shows Santa Claus in a sleigh being pulled by reindeer. In 1931, an artist by the name of Haddon Sundblom created Santa's final makeover for Coca-Cola Enterprises. Sundblom's Santa was dressed in the traditional red suit trimmed with white fur, but appeared more cheerful and robust than Nast's original drawings. So it was an illustration for a soft drink manufacturer's marketing campaign that finally came to define Santa Claus as the world now knows him. Well, come on, let's be realistic here. There have been just a few changes in fashion since 1822, or even 1931 for that matter. But popular perception hasn't allowed this man to truly update his image or wardrobe in well over 100 years. Even though it's probably just as well that he was never overly fond of bell-bottom trousers. What I'm trying to say is, if you need Santa Claus to wear the red suit, he wears the red suit. But I also happen to know that he's just as comfortable in an old gray sweatshirt, a pair of khaki pants, and fleece-lined slippers. The point is, it's really all up to you. Just remember that needing Santa Claus is only part of it, the easiest part, in fact. You also need to define him for yourself, and it's not a good idea to allow others to do that part of it for you. One man's trash can very well be another man's treasure. Take it from an elf who knows. Your concept of the spirit of Christmas, like your concept of God, is a very personal thing. You also have to guard against being too willing to believe in everything that falls into your lap. That isn't always a mark of wisdom. For instance, if you accepted, without question, the 4 statements I made at the very beginning of this introduction, you were wrong. My name isn't Marvin.
The world is full of elves. Genuine belief seems to have left us. Walt Whitman. When humans are born into the world, they are what we call littles. When they grow up, they become biggles. And the time it takes for a little to become a biggle is never exactly the same for every single person. This is because a person's age really has nothing to do with whether or not they will have become a biggle or they haven't. Humans will tell you otherwise, of course. This is because humans measure their growth in years. After a certain number of years pass, littles, whether they want to or not, are simply expected to become biggles and shift over into a world where less than 65% of the people in it are happy. And, by the way, American biggles are, on average, only 69% happy, but they consider happiness more important to them than money, moral goodness, and even going to heaven. The interesting thing about this process of growing is that the little never stops existing. Some Biggles don't like to believe this, but it's true. The little part of a person is always there. The Biggle part eventually develops around it. Humans call this growing up, but as you see, it's really a matter of growing around. When this happens, it's sometimes very hard to be able to find the little part of a person. That's why some people think the little part has gone forever, but it never does. It's always there, hidden away deep inside. Some Biggles forget this, but then some Biggles forget so many things. A good many Biggles have forgotten what it's like to be little. Can you imagine what Christmas time must be like for them? Now, for some people, the change from little to Biggle happens very quickly. For others, the change is much slower and often takes a bit of effort. For a few, for a very, very special few, the change never really happens at all. Oh, they may have Biggle bodies, but the little never got lost inside of them. And they are the most special Biggles of all. Biggles are not generally aware that the world is full of elves. But then, most Biggles are not really aware of a lot of things. Many Biggles simply have knowledge of something. Of course, having knowledge is very commendable in its place. There are people who work rather hard at it and take enormous pride in believing that they have more knowledge than others. It's just that having knowledge doesn't necessarily mean that someone is particularly aware of anything. I honestly don't think it will come as a shock that a great many Biggles seem to be afflicted with having knowledge without awareness. That makes it especially hard on elves, because while most Biggles have some knowledge of elves, they're still not absolutely sure we exist. On the rare occasion, when we actually find a human being willing to admit that elves do exist, they too often qualify their testimonies by adding that we only exist in their imaginations. Okay, let me ask you a question. Do airplanes exist? Can we assume most of you are aware that they do? More to the point, can you even imagine your world without them? Well, there was a time, and I remember it quite well, when airplanes did not exist. What's more, the world got along quite nicely without them. There was once a time when, on Christmas Eve, littles pressed their wide-eyed faces against frosty candlelit window panes to gaze with breathless wonder into starry skies. Why? Because there was once a time when children knew that only Santa Claus could fly. The star-sprinkled Christmas Eve skies of yesterday belonged to him alone. It's almost impossible now to understand just how glorious the thought of a flying sleigh used to be to the littles of the world. Speaking of airplanes, have you ever wondered why Orville and Wilbur Wright chose the month of December to make their first flight at Kitty Hawk? Well, they discovered what we elves had known for a long time. The winds are better for flight during December. And if you don't believe me, ask a reindeer. Consider, too, that once upon a time, Orville and Wilbur were littles, too. They lived in the world I just described. Have you ever wondered how the thought of a manned flight actually occurred to them? It's just possible that the idea was first born on a Christmas Eve long ago, while two young brothers stood in breathless wonder, faces pressed against a frosty window pane, gazing up together into a starry night sky. Well, don't you see? Before it became a reality, manned flight had to first be imagined. Imagination is the very source of all your creativity. In fact, you only have to glance back at your history books to understand that once human beings begin to imagine impossible things, it's not long before they find some way to make those dreams possible. The thought of elves being real has existed in people's imagination certainly as long as they've thought of flying, even though people once said that both ideas were impossible. And just look what's happened with flying. So to say that elves are real in your imagination is almost as good as saying elves are real, period. You don't need to understand how. Just enjoy the fact that we are. Most Biggles don't believe in elves because they've forgotten how much fun it used to be when they could believe. Littles, for instance, can watch a magician perform and absolutely believe that their seeing is magic. Biggles, seeing the same thing, often spend their time trying to figure out the trick. Sir Herbert Read said that in the process of education, we are psychically deformed because we are compelled to accept a social concept of normality, which excludes the free expression of aesthetic impulse. In other words, being a Biggle can sometimes be a real bummer. A very wise man once said that the price of wisdom is sorrow. That's because having knowledge can sometimes take away the magic. On the other hand, imagination, inventiveness, and fantasy can often bring our dreams to life with wondrous truth and power. Sadly enough, the worst thing a little will eventually learn in this world is how to begin to doubt. When that happens, it's a sure sign that childhood is soon coming to an end. Most Biggles have a habit of doubting things they don't understand. I just don't think Biggles realize how much energy it takes to keep doubting. If they did, we'd certainly have more believers in the world than we do now. I suppose most people think you have to understand something before you're able to enjoy it, and I freely admit to once harboring that same belief myself. But something occurred one day that changed the way I thought about everything. Let me tell you how it happened. We elves at the North Pole generally refer to Santa Claus as the boss. Well, one day, the boss came into the workshop with a brand new toy. It was a wonderful thing with wheels and levers and buttons, and when you turned it on, it moved. Absolutely fascinated, I studied that toy for hours, trying to figure out how it worked. I couldn't. Finally, taking it back to the boss, I explained my frustration. He merely smiled and leaned back in his chair. "Do you like grapes?" he asked me with a twinkle in his eye. "Yes, I do," I answered. "Do you understand grapes?" he asked. I paused to think for a moment. Nobody had ever asked me that question before. "Well, no," I finally replied. "Now that I think about it, I guess I really don't understand grapes at all." The boss leaned forward in his chair, the way he does when he has something very special to say. "Still enjoy grapes, though, don't you?" he said with a wink. The boss had a point. "I do enjoy grapes a great deal." "So," he smiled, "maybe you should give that toy another try." I took his advice. Well, that wonderful new toy and I went back to the workshop, and I spent the whole afternoon just playing with it, enjoying what it was without worrying anymore about having to understand how it worked. And do you know what happened? After a while, it was as if the simple act of enjoying it began to open up all of its hidden mysteries to me. I even began to understand it. Now, elves are smart, but we don't know everything. So whenever we do learn something new, we tend to celebrate it. And that day was a real celebration for me, I can tell you that. It's always been amazing to me how Biggles will sit quietly together on Christmas morning, watching Littles playing with their new gifts. If you look closely, just behind their smiles, you'll notice something identical in practically every pair of Biggle eyes. If it isn't sadness, it's certainly something very, very close to it. Do you know why? I think, secretly, those Biggles would enjoy nothing more than to sit down on the floor and enjoy being little again, just one more time. Most of them never do, of course, but only because they don't allow themselves to listen to the little who's still alive inside of them. That short, healing distance from the sofa to the floor becomes one of the hardest, most difficult moves in any Biggle's life. There are times when the little inside of every Biggle would like so very much to come out and play. I think it's such a shame they're not often allowed that privilege and pleasure, most especially at Christmas time. Biggles are Biggles, after all, and as near as I've been able to decipher it, there seems to be some unspoken code that begins to dictate what a Biggle can or cannot do. I don't think anybody ever wrote it down anywhere. Biggles just seem to somehow learn about it and spend the better part of their Biggle years trying very hard to follow it. Most of them don't even know why. it seems they do it simply because everyone else appears to be doing it. Most people, however, fail to notice that no one else seems to be having a particular happy time, so everyone just keeps on doing it. An empty cycle is therefore passed from one generation to the next. The puzzling thing is that every human being is a unique individual. No two of you are ever exactly alike. It's the way you're made. Yet most of you will spend your lives trying as hard as you can to be just like everybody else. Oh, it's one of your best excuses for everything. Well, you say, everybody else does it, or everybody else has one. So with everybody spending all their time trying to do the things they don't honestly want to do, everything has finally become so confusing that humans have even invented special kinds of doctors just to help them figure out why they eventually become so unhappy. As far as Biggles are concerned, elves have a lot of things going against them. We may, on first glance, appear nothing more than a bunch of subordinate clauses, but the simple fact is that the world is full of us. Biggles just don't want to admit it. I suppose their reasoning is that nobody else believes in elves, so once again, they just drift along with the mainstream. This is something they like to call maturity. Elves have a few fans, of course. J.R.R. Tolkien, Will Ferrell, and that game called Dungeons & Dragons certainly gave us a boost in the public relations department. But then again, there's a difference between Tolkien elves and Christmas elves. You won't find a single Christmas elf living in Middle-earth, and not one of us understands or speaks the Sinadrin language. Additionally, an Isuzu elf is not an elf. It's a truck. Elf Aquitaine is not a drink. It's a French oil company. Still, in all fairness, I can't put all of the blame for existing confusion on Biggles. Ever since they were littles, they've only seen pictures of us in fairy tale books where we have pointed little ears, beards, skinny legs, and wrinkled tights, sort of a visual cross between Shakespeare and Star Trek. Well, face it, you don't see too many people walking around the streets wearing outfits like that, at least not since the 60s ended every day. Imagine your reaction if you did. I mean, I'm certainly not implying that we don't ever wear tights and beards, or even those stupid little pointed hats with a bell attached to the tip. We do sometimes, but not always, and certainly not when we visit the world of humans. Remember, it's not our job to prove that we exist. When we visit the world of humans, we dress exactly the way you dress. In fact, I have to admit to actually enjoying the occasional current fashion statement. Here's something I'll bet you've never considered. When we visit your world, we don't just wear what you wear. We actually look like you, too. We can do that, you know. We learned it from Santa Claus. He does it all the time. Have you ever dropped something on a busy sidewalk and had someone pick it up and hand it back to you? The chances are very good that the person who did it was an elf in human form. Most of the people who take the time in crowded department stores to help lost littles find their mothers are actually elves. You've probably bumped into Christmas elves hundreds of times without even realizing it. Want to know why we do it? Why we pay these little visits to your human world? I'll tell you, and you can call it an experiment in elfin psychology if you want to, but it's the truth. We do it because we've learned quite a bit about the way human minds work. We even figured most of it out before you ever came up with the idea of psychologists. Here's the deal. Since we know that you always seem to do things because other people are doing them, we came up with what I think is a very clever strategy. Suppose, just suppose, you saw what you thought were people doing nice things for others. Being human, you'd simply assume that everybody else was doing nice things for other people. And since humans don't like to be different from anybody else, sooner or later, you'd join the crowd. That's what we decided at any rate, and we were right. I'm not saying that humans only learn to do kind things for each other as a result of elfin influence alone. Not at all. If everybody still had a little living inside of them, that means everyone also harbors some bit of innate kindness as well, especially around Christmas time. Because Christmas is a time when the little in you always stirs, and most often speaks directly to your heart. What's more, Christmas is one of the few times you tend to pause and honestly listen. What happens as a result? You begin to feel better inside. For a moment, for one simple, beautiful moment, it doesn't matter whether or not anyone else around you is doing something kind or even says thank you because you're doing it. You do it anyway, and that's what counts. No one really has to know. No one even has to notice. But here's something else, and it's the main reason you should never doubt the existence of elves in your world. Christmas time, aside from everything else, is a time when human spirits seem to join together in some glorious unspoken bond the world over. We don't have to understand how it happens. All we have to do is try to be aware of it when it does happen, and enjoy the happening. It's not as difficult as you may think. Sometimes it's only a matter of slowing down the hectic pace of everyday life. Often it's a matter of simply taking some time away from what you usually spend most of your life concentrating on. Otherwise, you're only blindly following the unspoken Biggle code of behavior that finally only leads to empty promises and a lonely heart. Our time is finite. Our kisses under the mistletoe aren't unlimited, you know. That number is also finite and set by an old tradition. According to the custom, which began long ago in England, each time a kiss is claimed under a mistletoe bough, the young man is supposed to pick off a berry. When all the berries are gone, there's no more kissing. Over the years, we've somehow managed to fool ourselves into thinking that, like kisses under the mistletoe, our time on this earth is also unlimited. Littles are lots of things, but of all the things a little is or ever can be, a little is love. Pure and simple love. To say we draw closer to the little inside of us at Christmas time is to say we also draw closer to the love inside of us. Whenever we do just one small act of kindness, we set free a bit of that love. We let it go out into a world that so desperately needs it. Now, I'm going to let you in on a great secret. It's the simple proof that elves do exist, that the world is actually full of them. All you have to do is open your heart wide enough to accept a brand new idea. It's just this. If a little is love, and if all of you still have a little inside of yourselves, then all of you also have the ability to love unconditionally. You never grow too old to love. You will never go so far away that love's light can't guide you safely back home again. When you commit a single act of kindness, unseen or unappreciated though it may appear to be, you bring a bit more of that loving light into the world. In that brief moment of your life, wherever you are, and for whatever you are doing that's kind, you become an elf. You do! It's probably happened to you already without you even knowing it. When it happens, when you add just one act of kindness to the world, it's as though you light a candle in some dark place. In that instant, the true spirit of goodwill towards men becomes stronger and brighter everywhere. The love within that light pushes a little more of the darkness away. A 7-year-old once said, "Love is what's in the room with you at Christmas if you only stop opening presents and listen." That's why Christmas is always such a cherished time, because at least for one single day out of the entire year, we allow ourselves to reclaim the happiness of youth, whether we happen to be elves or people. When that happens, we suddenly become wonderfully aware of things again. You can't help it. It's almost as if we are able to see, hear, touch, taste, and feel the world and everything in it for the very first time. There are 3 stages of a man's life. He believes in Santa Claus. He doesn't believe in Santa Claus. He is Santa Claus. So I ask you, how can people not believe in magic? How can people not believe in themselves? The world is absolutely full of elves, and you are one of them.
Of Hallowgivingness,
heroes, and the North Pole. Christmas is over, and business is business. Franklin Pierce Adams. About 450 miles north of Greenland, at the very top of Earth's axis, laced by the cold, gray waters of the Arctic Ocean, is a desolate place of drifting ice and snow, known as the North Pole. This is, of course, the geographic North Pole, not to be confused with the magnetic North Pole. Compass needles point to the magnetic North Pole, which is actually just as well. There's recently been a steady flow of nuclear submarines, jet planes, weather balloons, and National Geographic photographers in and out of that area. I say just as well because it's much better to have all that traffic moving through the magnetic North Pole. This is because Santa Claus and his elves live in the geographic North Pole, where, believe me, the fewer interruptions there are, the better our lives are going to be. Considering what you know, or most probably don't know about the place, the obvious question becomes, why did Santa Claus ever choose to settle on a piece of real estate as far away and as desolate as the North Pole? Granted, it is the top of the world, but on the other hand, you certainly don't read about people retiring to the North Pole, do you? Everyone heads south to Miami where it's warm. How many families have you ever known who've loaded up the station wagon for a vacation in the North Pole? Again, they usually head to Disneyland, where it's almost always warm. The simple and unadorned truth is that most of the people who've ever visited the North Pole never actually decided to go there themselves. They were sent. And most of the ones who actually did make an individual decision to go did it simply because they couldn't come up with anything else better to do with their time. For Robert Peary and Matthew Henson, it was a matter of wanting to take their sled dogs for a very long walk. We may as well be bottom line here. Nobody's ever won a trip for two to the North Pole on any television game show. If you want a terrific laugh, get the Club Med folks on the phone and ask about their resort location closest to the geographic North Pole. Try thumbing through the pages of any real estate magazine to see what's listed under North Pole condominium opportunities. Did you know that an elf is required to work for only 2 days out of an entire year? It's the truth. However, considering that a single day in the North Pole is 6 months long, that's not really saying one whole heck of a lot now, is it? I think I've made my point. The North Pole is a vast, endless, enormous, and whopping expanse of frigid nothing. Unless, of course, you count the ice, wind, and snow. Nobody lives at the North Pole. Nobody ever really goes there, at least not on their own accord. So why? Why in the name of Christmas did Santa Claus ever in his right mind choose the North Pole as home? The answer is, are you ready for this? He didn't! Do you actually think, given a choice, he would have selected the geographic North Pole as the number one place he wanted to call Mikasa? Even national hockey teams have turned the North Pole down. And if you can't tell where the ice ends, players are always out of bounds. Now, if Santa Claus did not choose the North Pole for himself, who did? Who made the decision to take this poor man, beloved by millions of people the world over, and stick him, along with the rest of us, mind you, at the top of the blooming world in the middle of a frozen nothing? You did. That's right. Don't look so surprised. The shoe fits, Cinderella. You made the decision. And by you, I naturally mean you humans. And please, excuse me, but I've been dying to ask you one question. What is it with you people? Is this any way to show affection? For years now, you've gone off on incredibly wild tangents, glibly deciding amongst yourselves that we have nothing better to do than to live at the North Pole, occupying ourselves, not to mention our valuable time, with the most asinine activities. Give us a break, folks. This may come as a huge shock to some of you, but elves don't march around all day singing catchy little tunes like the Oompa Loompas did in Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory. Trust me on this. It's high time you people faced up to a few facts about yourselves and how you treat your heroes. Did you know there's a town in Spencer County, Indiana, just 38 miles from Evansville, called Santa Claus? Well, there is. Every year, the post office in Santa Claus remails more than 1 million pieces of Christmas letters just so they can go out with a Santa Claus postmark on them. On the surface, this may seem like an absolutely delightful thing for a town to do. Restamp envelopes so people can't say they've never gotten a letter from Santa Claus. But think about this for a moment. If you humans have long since decided that Santa Claus lives at the North Pole, why are you sending 1 million pieces of Christmas mail to the state of Indiana? And just in case you're thinking that the dear citizens of Santa Claus incorporated their little town for the express purpose of handling this annual deluge of Christmas mail, let me put your minds to rest. The town was named Santa Claus because the name Santa Fe had already been taken. The name Santa Claus was only a desperate second choice, for which, no doubt, some Santa Clausians, most especially the town's unfortunate postmaster, have good reason to rue. Don't get me wrong. Heaven knows what we'd do at the North Pole with 1 million pieces of mail, along with everything else we have to do. It's just that you know where we live. Indiana's a very fine state, but it's not home sweet home for Santa Claus and his merry band of elves. No, we're freezing our keisters off up at the North Pole because you stuck us here. Actually, a man named George P. Webster was the first person to give everyone the idea when he published a cute little poem in 1869 titled Santa Claus and His Works. Webster wrote that Santa Claus's home was near the North Pole in the ice and snow, and not one human being thought to ask if Webster had been enjoying one or two alcoholic beverages before he sat down to put the pen to paper. It was therefore unanimously decided that the boss would absolutely adore some choice real estate smack dab in the center of the geographical North Pole. Yet, when it honestly comes down to it, you don't really believe it yourselves, do you? Now, why is that? Well, let me simply suggest that the geographical North Pole, for all its fictitious allure, is not a place you would have chosen for yourselves. On the other hand, it's a wonderful place to which to relegate one of your greatest heroes. I'm even going to go a step farther and suggest that you may want to consider the occasional and somewhat sadistic side of your natures and having agreed to this choice in the first place. First of all, you chose someone truly worthy of emulation, someone whose unselfishness and... Someone whose unselfishness and sense of brotherhood are annually paraded about as an example worthy of following every single day of the year. Then, almost immediately, you started confusing everything. To begin with, Halloween merchandise is hardly out on corner drugstore shelves before those orange plastic jack-o'-lanterns are made to share counter space with boxes of Christmas cards, ornaments, and strings of computerized blinking lights. Ever tried shopping for your Thanksgiving turkey while the supermarket's taped music du jour happens to be, "It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas"? And you people actually wonder why you always feel so rushed during the holidays. Personally, and I know I'm digressing here, but I think you should give yourselves a break. As long as you're rushing through everything, why not combine all three holidays into one? Call it Hallow Givingmas, and just get it over with as soon as humanly possible, with a minimum amount of merchandising headaches, food preparation, mandatory relatives, crowded airports, and all the resulting depression. Of course, you'll never do it. You'll never do it because it's too logical. And logical behavior, I'm afraid, has never been your human forte. No, you'd still prefer 3 round trips to the attic. One for Halloween decorations, one for Thanksgiving decorations, and one for Christmas decorations. When instead, you could be making a single round trip to the attic for a single box of Hallowgivingmas decorations. And what's more, you could keep them on display in your home for 3 full months. Never happen, though. Too logical. Stay with me. I'm working around to my original point about heroes in the North Pole. Finally, the Christmas holidays arrive. The third installment in this annual bacchanal of rapid-fire holidays, and a classic example of how you treat heroes. Because, along with this particular holiday, come the Santa Clauses. Yes, I use the plural. Wooden, metal, plastic... small, medium, large, you just name it, and there's a Santa Claus clone to fit the bill. He's everywhere, and he's doing everything from selling used cars on television to parachuting into shopping center parking lots. He's shivering on almost every street corner, clanging that shrill and irritating little handbell. And just to add insult to injury, you've even got Santa coming after people with an axe in a movie called Silent Night, Deadly Night. Now, this is absolutely beyond the pale. National Enquirer hasn't taken him on yet, but I'm convinced it's only a matter of time. Still, no matter how you market, package, or present him, the fact remains that it's all done for one reason. The man is famous. He's a perfect role model, a VIP, a star, a legend, a genuine cultural icon. He's even bigger than Elvis. In short, what we've got here is a bona fide hero. And that's exactly why you stuck him in the North Pole. You don't honestly want to live with your role models on a daily basis. You only seem to be able to deal with them from afar. And the North Pole is about as far afar as you can get. What's more, you don't seem to handle your heroes too well in long doses. Even Santa Claus is only trotted out once a year. Granted, you can often snap the littles into line by reminding them that he's making a list and checking it twice. There were actually times when Santa Claus was referred to as Ashen Claus, which means Ash Nicholas, because Biggles thought that a few littles would think of Santa, aside from bringing toys, as being someone who always carried around a sack of ashes and a bundle of switches. But think about it. How many naughty littles have you ever really known who actually got switches or lumps of coal on Christmas morning? I don't think anyone honestly believes that this infamous list, supposedly kept by Santa, really amounts to a hill of beans. Naughty or nice, everybody's included in Christmas. Always. That's just the way the boss operates. And that's also why it's never a good idea to say to someone who's not being particularly nice, "You'll be sorry on Christmas morning." They never are. Most probably they never will be. That's because Christmas presents were never intended to be part of some grand reward system for being nice. I mean, nice certainly helps, but it's not the sole determining factor. Besides, we're talking about Christmas, not the Spanish Inquisition. The ancient Romans were actually the first ones to start the whole practice of exchanging presents. Every December, they celebrated a holiday called Saturnalia. During this particular time, everyone gave each other good luck presents of fruit, pastry, sometimes even gold. But that was it. These gifts weren't rewards for being nice. They were merely ways of saying good luck in the attempt to be much more realistic, if you ask me. In a strange sort of way, you human beings today are making heroism, as well as Christmas itself, almost unattainable. You're making it a matter of perfection, and that's never been the idea at all. For instance, suppose it was a rule that only people who'd been nice all year long were the ones who got presents on Christmas morning. Besides someone like Mother Teresa, who do you know who'd even have a reason to glance under the tree? Regardless of what television commercials tell you, and the average American sees or hears 560 advertisements a day, Christmas is not a perfect time celebrated by perfect people. The house is not always spotlessly clean, and the turkey is not always cooked to absolute perfection. The honest truth is that for most people, Christmas is a rushed and harried time of cooking, cleaning, wrapping presents, fielding relatives, fighting crowds in shopping malls, spending money, and meeting hundreds of deadlines. That's not Merry Christmas. That's Merry Crisis Management. Well, please take some advice from an elf who knows. Don't worry about being perfect. Never going to happen anyway. Remember what Benjamin Franklin wrote in Poor Richard's Almanac. Who is wise? He that learns from everyone. Who is powerful? He that governs his passions. Who is rich? He that is content. Who is that? Nobody. At the North Pole, we'd call this low self-esteem. Besides, no one ever gets penalized for not being perfect at Christmas. In fact, it actually works in reverse most of the time. The less perfect you are, the better holiday season you might possibly expect. Need an example? All right, here you are. Ebenezer Scrooge. Remember him? He was the stingiest, meanest man in town. Not at all the type of person you'd describe as a candidate for receiving Christmas gifts from anyone. So what happens to this stingy old miser in A Christmas Carol? Everybody in the book spends the major portion of the story being unbelievably nice to him. And this is a man who declares that any idiot celebrating Christmas should be boiled in his own Christmas pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart. He does everything but spit into people's faces, and still he gets visited by wonderful apparitions, learns to fly, drinks from the wine of human kindness, among other absolutely splendid things. And all for what? For being absolutely, completely, and unequivocally mean. The moral here is that simply being nice is definitely not a prerequisite for being rewarded on Christmas morning. Whatever happened to being nice simply because it was the decent thing to do? Life doesn't shape itself to fit into our personal value system or time schedule. It may very well be unwise to teach your littles that they are always going to be rewarded by other people for being nice. I think you know that human beings often have a tendency to react in a completely opposite manner. Good King Wenceslas, the guy with a Christmas carol named after him, was a 10th century Bohemian nobleman, Duke of Borovoy, who lived to be only 26 years old. He didn't live to be any older than that because his mother and twin brother killed him. And just to add insult to injury, they did him in while the poor man was attending a church service. A man so nice that his first name was Good. Go figure. On the other hand, only being nice to nice people is much too easy. Like preaching to the choir. There's a famous joke from the North Pole. Why did the elf cross the road? Answer: in order to see both sides. So go on, give yourself a challenge. Take a Scrooge to lunch. Better yet, give a Scrooge a hug. Won't cost you a dime, and the results may absolutely astound you, one way or the other. So what if you don't succeed the first time out? Hang in there. Stay with it. Tenacity has its virtues. Do you remember the famous Impressionist painter Claude Monet? He painted more than 300 pictures of the same lily pads in the same pond in his same backyard. Why? He stayed with the subject until he felt he'd gotten it right. Not perfect, just right. Well, I, for one, would like to say, way to go, Claude. The Times Mirror Center did a study entitled The Age of Indifference. Its subject was Young Americans and How They View the News. The title of the study wasn't just pulled out of thin air. This report concluded that your young Americans know less and care less about the news than any other generation of Americans in the last 50 years. Asked about career goals, almost none of those surveyed chose the helping occupations that they also rated highest in moral value. Asked for one wish, nearly every boy chose money. And the dreams of young people? $5 million and a day at the mall. Another study concluded that 70% of Americans believe that their country has no living heroes. About the same number say that your children have no role models. Some littles are even afraid of Santa Claus. We call them claustrophobics. So there you are, still. I can't help but wonder if you people have been looking in the right places. Most heroes are simply ordinary people placed in extraordinary situations. This premise accepted, every single human being can look forward to the opportunity of being a hero at one time or another. Because at some point in your life, the odds are that you will find yourself in an extraordinary situation. It will have nothing to do with the degree of perfection you have or haven't attained. Most probably, it will be a matter of simply keeping your wits about you and, in a split second, determining a rational and civilized course of action. Stated even more plainly, a hero is often an individual who sees something good that needs to be done and does it. Again, this is not a matter of perfection. It's a matter of doing what is right. This is why it's extremely important that you know why heroes are heroes. In Crystal City, Texas, there's a 6-foot-high stone monument dedicated to the comic strip character Popeye. Now you ask any little who Popeye is, and they'll tell you he's the one who eats his spinach. But Popeye the Sailor is not a hero because he eats his spinach. He's a hero because, generally, he recognizes what needs to be done and does it. Spinach just helps him get the job done more quickly. I do hope that's a relief to those of you who have always hated spinach and felt so much guilt all these many years. This hero concept is one of the reasons you've relegated the boss, along with the rest of us, to the North Pole. You've somehow gotten this crazy idea that Santa Claus is going to be disappointed with your lack of perfection if you allow him any closer. Of course, I have to admit that I can hardly fault you in this case. As I said before, you were raised to think he was keeping that infamous list and watching you all the time, just waiting for you to make a mistake. When you get right down to it, your concept of Santa Claus has been that he's more of a private detective than the true spirit of Christmas. That's because Santa Claus has already been defined for most people, and they simply accept the definition as presented. And to those of you who are scared stiff at the thought of even attempting to change the image of Santa Claus, let me remind you that subtle alterations have already been going on for years. For instance, in Bavaria, St. Nicholas was once considered to be only a message runner. That's to say, the Bavarians believed the boss's job was simply to take children's Christmas requests up to heaven. That was it. Bavarians believed it was a representative of the infant Jesus who actually delivered the gifts to the world on Christmas Eve. This heavenly representative was known in Bavaria as Liebes Christkind, or Dear Christ Child. When this tradition finally reached America, it went through several changes. Christkind became Kris Kringle, and the rest, as they say, is a happy holiday. Ooh. When the tradition finally reached America, it went through several changes. Christkind became Kris Kringle, and the rest, as they say, is happy holiday history. In Germany, St. Nicholas is known as Weihnachtsmann, which literally means Christmas man. In Russia, he's known as Father Frost. In France, he's Père Noël. In England, they call him Father Christmas, and the list goes on. The main thing to remember is that joy, happiness, and contentment, and Santa Claus are very personal things. We define them for ourselves through an ongoing process of internalization and re-examination. This is because life's truest meaning always comes from within, and only after we begin to focus on that internal vision. Just as our own concepts of happiness and contentment may change with time, so may our internal vision and definition of Santa Claus. Well, isn't it perhaps time to let go of a few things? To discard some of those old images of who you think the boss is and of just how he does what he does? At the very least, isn't this a wonderful opportunity to rethink and re-examine? This doesn't mean that you have to deny the little inside of you in the process, or discard a single warm memory of your past experience. You're going to happily discover that the little inside of you becomes a lot healthier when the weight of so much guilt doesn't have to be lugged around anymore. In fact, re-examining your entire concept of what and who all of your heroes are might be a very healthy thing to do. Just remember that demanding perfection of all your heroes is perfectly acceptable, so long as all of your heroes are saints. You'll be able to better accept the absence of perfection in some of your closer heroes when you're able to accept and forgive the lack of perfection in yourself. Leo Tolstoy said, "The highest purpose of art is to make people good by choice." Paraphrased, that's a fine description of Santa's purpose in the world as well. Good by choice, not by guilt. There's enough in this world humans should feel guilty about. Being less than perfect, particularly during the Christmas season, is just not one of them.
And that concludes our first hour of readings from Confessions of an Elf. The second hour will begin with a 5-minute musical interlude, and we'll pick up with Section 3.